Hello and welcome to Pod Rights. This is a series of podcasts from the Australian Human Rights Commission. I'm Graham Innes, the Disability Discrimination Commissioner. A new requirement has been added to the parliamentary process this year. Every bill tabled in Parliament must be accompanied by a human rights compatibility statement, and a specific parliamentary committee has been set up to scrutinise bills from a human rights perspective. Some might say nothing much will change in practical terms. Others might suggest that this is a federal charter of rights by stealth. The reality probably lies somewhere between those two claims. Joining me on this week's Pod Rights to tease out just where that reality lies is Philip Lynch. Phil has been Executive Director of the Human Rights Law Centre in Melbourne since 2006. He was previously the founding coordinator of the Pilch Homeless Persons Legal Clinic, and he's also worked as a lawyer with Allens Arthur Robinson. So welcome to Pod Rights, Phil, and firstly, just give us a quick picture of the work that your centre is involved in.
Sure. Well, we're a national specialist human rights law advocacy organisation. Our broad mandate is to promote and protect human rights in Australia and through Australian foreign policy, and we do that through an integrated combination of policy analysis and advocacy, research, law reform work, strategic and high impact litigation, and also capacity building education and training.
And is it fair to say, Phil, that as part of that work, and more specifically as part of your work around both the Victorian Charter of Rights and the campaign for a federal Charter of Rights, you've looked at these scrutiny and compatibility statement processes fairly closely?
Yeah, we certainly have. One of our core areas of focus is around strengthening legal recognition and protection of human rights, and also enhancing parliamentary scrutiny of and engagement with human rights. That's been a big part of our work at the national level, and it's certainly been a big focus of our work in Victoria under the Victorian Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities.
Okay. Well, can we look at the history first, Phil? How did these changes come about to the federal law?
Well, essentially they came about as a consequence of the 2009 human rights consultation chaired by Father Frank Brennan. As you are aware, and many listeners will no doubt be aware, that was an extensive process in which the Australian public was asked about the importance of human rights and how to better promote, protect and realise human rights for all Australians. It received a record number of submissions, over 35,000. The vast majority, some 90% of which, called for better legal recognition and protection of human rights. And one of the committee's core recommendations was that there be established a joint parliamentary committee on human rights and a process for enhanced parliamentary scrutiny of human rights and consideration of human rights in the policy development process. And that recommendation came about as a result of the finding that there was inadequate consideration of and engagement with human rights, both in the legislative and policy development process and in parliamentary enactment of legislation.
Okay, so as a result of those things, the federal government legislated last year, as I said, to introduce the need for compatibility statements and for scrutiny of bills. What does the new law firstly require public servants and secondly the Parliament to do?
Well, for public servants, what it requires they do is give due consideration to human rights in the development of law and policy. It establishes a process by which all proposed legislation must be accompanied by a statement of compatibility, which sets out whether and how that piece of legislation is compatible with Australia's international human rights obligations. It's an extremely important process occurring early in the stage of policy development, and it's intended to be to adopt a preventative approach to human rights issues, to at the earliest stage identify potential human rights implications of a piece of law or a proposed policy, and seek to ensure that it's developed in a way which best protects and least infringes human rights.
Mm.
So that's a requirement on the part of public servants.
And when you talk about international human rights obligations, you basically mean, don't you, the UN or international treaties which Australia has signed up to in the area of human rights?
Exactly. So human rights are actually defined in the legislation as being the human rights and freedoms that are set out in the seven core international human rights treaties to which Australia is a party, all of which in relation to Australia played a key role around negotiation.
Mm.
Whilst they are, international human rights, it would be a misnomer to think that they're somehow foreign or alien to Australia, that they come down to us from Geneva or New York. In fact, Australia has been a key player in the negotiation and the development of that international human rights framework from the very outset, with Doc Evatt being a key architect of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and Australia being closely involved in the drafting of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, and so on.
And having had involvement in all those treaties, really, in one way or another, haven't we? So
exactly. Yeah.
Now, sorry, I interrupted you, and you were going to go on and tell us, because you've talked about what the public servants have to do, what does the Parliament have to do?
So, well, Parliament gets the benefit of the public servants and ultimately the minister preparing a statement of compatibility, which is tabled in Parliament together with proposed legislation, and that statement sets out whether and how the legislation is compatible with human rights. So that statement is intended to inform parliamentary dialogue and consideration of the legislation and its human rights implications. The legislation also establishes a new specialist joint committee on human rights. This will be a committee which is comprised of five members of the House of Reps and five senators, and their task is threefold. First, it's to consider the human rights implications of any proposed legislation. Second, it's to consider, at their discretion, the human rights implications of existing legislation. And finally, it's to conduct human rights inquiries on broader matters that are referred to it by the Attorney General. And in relation to all of those matters, it reports back to Parliament its findings, the results of which are intended to enhance parliamentary debate about human rights and also ensure much greater transparency and accountability in relation to how we're discharging our international human rights obligations.
So we assume then, Phil, that we know then that the compatibility statement will be tabled when the bill is introduced, and we assume that if the committee scrutinises that particular bill, they'll report back to Parliament prior to the final decision being made. Is that the way it works?
Certainly, would be the committee and the process working at its optimal. Yes, we've seen some regrettable instances in Victoria where under the Victorian Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities, which has a similar statement of compatibility process and parliamentary committee scrutiny process, the legislation has been enacted or passed by Parliament even though it is still before the committee for consideration. And regrettably, the tendency to do that is in the areas where often the human rights ramifications of a bill are most acute, because it's often those bills that have big human rights implications. I've got, for example, a Northern Territory emergency response legislation in mind, 400 odd pages of legislation passed in 1 or 2 days.
Yes.
It's often those bills that are passed with the greatest urgency and haste.
Mm. And interestingly, there's a call at the moment, I think, isn't there, for the Better Futures, the revised Northern Territory response legislation, which was actually introduced to the Parliament before this compatibility statements law came into force. There's a call for that to be a piece of legislation considered by the committee.
Yeah, absolutely. It certainly should be. And although the legislation was introduced before the requirement for statements of compatibility, so there was no statement accompanying the Stronger Futures legislation, there's nothing in principle to prevent the committee, once established, from examining that legislation either pre or post enactment,
yes,
if it so desires.
Sure, Sure. What do you think compatibility statements will look like? And given what you've said in your last answer, how much chance do you think will people and community organisations have to look at them and comment on them?
Well, what will they look like? The intent is that these statements set out how a piece of legislation engages human rights, whether that's an engagement that it results in their limitation or interference, or an engagement which results in the enhanced promotion and protection of human rights. Mm. And where there is a limitation or interference, sets out the evidence base and the policy rationale for that interference, with a view to demonstrating that such an interference is reasonable, necessary and proportionate, which is the test for the legality of a limitation on human rights under international law. So that's what we would expect them to look like, and that's how they've largely looked in Victoria and the ACT. Mm-hmm. We do, about three sitting days into the 2012 Parliament, actually have some examples of statements of compatibility now to test that against. Mm. And some of the statements have been very good, and some have been somewhat inadequate.
Mm. So I guess we're just going to have to wait and see how that comes out. But I know that there is quite a bit of work going on within government to, if you like, have an impact on developing a culture around how these statements are prepared.
Yes, certainly. The Attorney General's Department has done quite extensive training around the human rights obligations of public servants under the new legislation, and the process of legislative development and human rights scrutiny, and to their great credit have made publicly available all of the resources, materials and training that they're providing to public servants, which contributes to much greater transparency and accountability in the process.
Yeah, which is great, as you say. Phil, I know you've covered this to an extent before, and it's a somewhat speculative question, but how much weight do you expect these statements to have during the parliamentary debate of laws?
Well, I certainly hope that they have significant weight.
Mm.
How much might they have? I think it's too early to say.
Mm.
Certainly, they've been not so much the statements, but the reports of the Joint Parliamentary Committee in the UK have been very influential and have resulted in some substantial legislative amendment, even following the introduction of a piece of legislation to one of the Houses of Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
That probably hasn't occurred to the same degree in Victoria. One of the reasons for that is perhaps that the Victorian Committee vested with this scrutiny is the Scrutiny of Acts and Regulations Committee, which was a committee which pre-existed the Charter of Human Rights.
Right.
It didn't originally have a human rights mandate, but was vested with that under the Charter. So it's not a specialist human rights committee. One of the great strengths of the UK model, and now the Commonwealth model, is that this is a joint committee which is specifically established to report on the human rights compatibility of legislation, and with members who discharge that obligation with diligence and in good faith, supported by a secretariat with appropriate international human rights expertise.
Yep.
I think the process has great potential.
Mm. Do you think then that the process will assist to reinforce the importance of human rights in the public service culture and in the broader Australian community?
Yes, I think it will. I mean, it requires that all public servants involved in the development of legislation familiarise themselves with international human rights standards and turn their mind to those standards and report on those standards in the development of legislation. And that's something that's, I think, got the potential to be quite normative and educative.
Mm. Now, you've mentioned the Victorian and UK processes and compared them in some respects. Are there other ways in which this new federal process is better than or more problematic than the Victorian and UK and ACT processes?
Well, I think it's both better and worse.
Mm.
It's worse than the processes in Victoria and the ACT in that the legislation on its face doesn't require that the statements of compatibility set out how a piece of legislation is or isn't compatible with human rights. In Victoria, the Charter actually requires not only that the statement set out whether there is compatibility with human rights, but how, which requires an explication of the legislation and its human rights implications. That's not required on the face of the Commonwealth legislation, but nevertheless one hopes that, or certainly I hope, that implemented in good faith, that kind of explanation will appear in statements of compatibility. That was certainly the intent of the legislation as set out in the explanatory memorandum and also the Attorney General's second reading speech. So it's potentially weaker on that count, but it's also much, much stronger on another count, because the Victorian and UK processes occur under the Victorian Charter and the UK Human Rights Act respectively, and those pieces of legislation are limited in their scope to the protection of civil and political rights. The process of scrutiny only examines whether a piece of legislation is or is not consistent with rights such as the prohibition against torture, freedom of expression, association, assembly, and so on, traditional civil and political rights. The Commonwealth process goes much further, because it requires scrutiny against all international human rights treaties to which Australia is a party, which includes not only the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, but also the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, which protects rights such as the right to adequate healthcare, housing, education and so on, and group-specific treaties such as the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and so on. So the process also has the potential to be much more rigorous and holistic than that which occurs in Victoria and the ACT and the UK.
Well, I guess we'll see. Finally, Phil, is this law a Charter of Rights by stealth, or will it have no practical impact?
It's not a Charter of Rights by stealth. The key feature of any Charter of Rights is that it imposes legal obligations on government and public servants and public authorities to act compatibly with human rights. And this legislation does nothing of the sort. There's no legal obligation to act compatibly with human rights. There's just an obligation to give consideration to human rights in the process of developing legislation. The other key feature of a Charter of Rights is that there be judicial oversight and the availability of judicial remedies, and the courts have no role whatsoever to play under the Human Rights Parliamentary Scrutiny Act. So it's certainly nothing like a Charter of Rights by stealth. On the other hand, do I think it'll have no practical impact? No, certainly not. I think it's a significant but modest piece of legislation that has the potential to contribute to much better public authority engagement with human rights, the development of legislation in a manner that's compatible with human rights, and also parliamentary discourse and, by extension, public discourse about and understanding of and engagement with human rights. So I think it's got the potential to have quite significant and positive impact.
Well, thanks, Phil, for this opportunity to talk about this. It's an important change in the law, which, as you say, should increase the role of that human rights play in our legislative process. And it's great to have a chance to talk through the process and get a better understanding of it. And thanks to all of you listening to PodRights. Remember, this podcast is for you. So if you have a suggestion of someone with whom I should talk, or a comment on the podcast, please email me at podrights@humanrights.gov.au, or find me and message me on Facebook or Twitter. Just search for Graeme Innes, GraeMeinnes. Also, if you want to become more active on human rights issues, have a look at the Tell Me Something I Don't Know.gov.au website, which is our Something in Common project, where you can read fascinating human rights facts and stories, participate in polls, add your own content, and find out what you can do to advance human rights issues in Australia. And keep your podcatchers ready for the next PodRights in the series, because human rights is for everyone, everywhere, every day. I'm Graeme Innes. Goodbye for now.